From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Terry Tempest Williams' latest project is a personal reflection on America's national parks. And she says at first she thought she would create portraits of some of the parks. She chose 12. She thought it would be straightforward and exuberant, as she puts it. And if you know Terry's writing, you can imagine what it would have been like. But she says, in fact, it didn't work out that way. She found herself writing outside of her comfort zone. Metaphor and lyricism weren't going to be enough, she says, not with the scale of climate change and shrinking habitats, and not with people so divided. So in her new book, she moves from talking about a sense of place to an ethic of place, especially in the country's national parks. Terry Tempest Williams will join us today to explain the difference after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Terry Tempest Williams' own father admits it. Strange things happen when Terry's around. She sees creatures everywhere, even elusive ones, and she says when she goes to a national park, she always meets the miraculous. Terry's a great storyteller, and her father says people think she's making this stuff up, but he's seen it. And maybe it's a kind of humility in the way she approaches these places she spent a lifetime exploring and writing about. In her new book, she writes, "We are not the only species who lives and dreams on this planet. There is something enduring that circulates in the heart of nature that deserves respect and attention." Today in the program, Terry Tempest Williams is back with us to talk about this new project, which turned out to be harder than she thought. The book is called The Hour of Land, A Personal Topography of America's National Parks, and she's joining us in the studio. Terry, of course, you know, she's the author of 15 books, including Refuge and When Women Were Birds. Welcome back.
Thank you, Doug. There's nobody better than you. I appreciate being here.
Let's start with a story that you tell or allude to anyway, and it's not in the book. Well, it's in the book. You're getting ready to read, but I want you to tell the story first. You're 8 years old. You and your family had gone up to the Timpanogos Cave thing that everyone does when we're kids. But this was a big deal for you because this is how you put it in the book. You say this experience up in that cave, in the crazy darkness, for those who have been there, you know what that's like. When they shut off the lights, it's such a novel thing. But that experience marked you.
It did. And I love how you always literally go to the heart of the matter. You know, all of us who have grown up in Utah and Salt Lake City, you make your annual pilgrimage, you know, as a child to Timpanogos Cave. And I actually was with a church group, a primary group. Yeah. I think I was 8 years old, you know, and we march up the paved mile and a half, and there are those big doors in a park. Ranger greets you. The doors open. You've been told how many years that this is the Sleeping Maiden, the Ute story, and that inside is the heart of the maiden, inside the mountain. We walk in, it's cold, it's damp, you see these stalagmites that register as teeth. You walk on that platform through Father Time's jewel box, through the Valley of Sleep, and it's almost more than I could take. It was so thrilling, because how often have you wondered what is inside the mountain? And then I'll never forget, we turn the corner and there is the great heart of Timpanogos, backlit. You wonder if you were to touch it, would it register as heat or cold? And I was completely mesmerized. And I believed that it was beating, so much so that I lost track of my group, and they obviously lost track of me. And suddenly the door slams, the lights go off, and I am in serious darkness.
Yeah.
And as you say, you know, you can't even see your hand wave. I knew that I was within hand's reach of the heart. I assumed they would come back after me. And I don't know when, Doug, fear shifted into awe, but I literally felt that beating heart of the mountain. And I think for the rest of my life, I've been seeking that feeling, that kind of the essence of something so much older and wilder than we are. The lights came back on, the door opened, and there was my primary teacher, greatly relieved. And I wasn't in that much of a hurry to leave. It wasn't about being saved. It was about what saved me and continues to do so daily.
I mentioned in the introduction, there's something that you refer to in the book that your father said. This was in another place, but he says that you had been in, you're in the Teddy Roosevelt National Park, and you write about that. We'll come back to that in a second here, but you're with the superintendent of the park, Valerie, and your father. And you had had this experience with Valerie some years back with these great horned owls. And when you're there with your father, you see these red-headed woodpeckers. It's kind of extraordinary.
They're the most magnificent beings.
Are they?
It's like these ruby-headed beings with black and white flashes of light and dark as they move in the world. They're amazing. I'd never seen one before.
So you're seeing this and you're like, Valerie, do you remember that time we also saw the great horned owls in your dad? This is when your father says to Valerie, strange things always happen when Terry's around. Now, and I wanted to ask you about that.
Maybe it's strange things happen when my father's around.
Maybe it is. But do you think there's something to that? Because at least your father's saying, this is really weird. Whenever Terry's around, stuff like this happens. And is there something to that? Not to be superstitious about it, but is there something about your sense of patience or awareness or something that explains that?
I don't think so. I think it's the most common thing in the world that we literally live in a magnificent world, that we live in a world where the miraculous is before us, whether it's delicate arch, whether it's landscape arch, whether it's the maze, the dollhouse, emerald pools. You know, we can go over all of the place names in our own beloved state of Utah. I don't think it's unusual. I think it's about showing up with your eyes wide open. I think it's about paying attention. I think it's about being open. And it is everywhere, all the time, all around us.
How did this project get started? And talk a little bit about how it changed, because you say in the book that as you were sort of wandering around national parks, deciding how to write about them or what to write about them, your original intention was, hey, I'll make these portraits, these beautiful and exuberant portraits. But you say it didn't turn out that way. This is how you put it in the book. It turned out to be among the most rigorous assignments you'd ever given yourself. Why?
It's really true, Doug. I love our national parks. Again, as Utahns, you know, we have five in our backyard. Zion, Bryce, Capitol Reef, Arches, Canyonlands, we grew up with them. And if you go north in any direct, you know, you go north and you've got Grand Teton and Yellowstone. So you've got the Colorado Plateau to the south. You've got the Greater Yellowstone to the north. You've got the Great Basin with the bristlecone pines. You know, it's all around us. So I thought, finally, I just want to write a book about joy, you know, in our national parks. I've written about Rwanda. I've written about my mother's journals that were blank, you know, a rising Great Salt Lake, and the death of my mother. And I thought, I want joy. I want to celebrate. But I think, as with anything, the deeper we go, we see that it is a shadowed landscape, that there are layers, even a stratigraphy, not just to the Grand Canyon, but our own histories. And it was really humbling. And I have to say, you know, I was so grateful for my colleagues here at the University of Utah, Greg Smoke among them, who really talked me through my own ignorance of, you know, what's really behind our national parks and what about the displacement of Native people, whether it's in Yosemite, whether it's in Yellowstone or Glacier National Parks, that it's never one story but multiple stories. And who's telling the story and who benefits. So I think I had to really let go of, again, my bias, single issue, wilderness, and really look at what are our national parks and Why, when you go to Gettysburg National Battlefield, do you never hear the word slavery mentioned? Again, who benefits? You know, when we think about the Bears Ears National Monument and 20-plus tribes in the Colorado Plateau, Navajo, Ute, Hopi among them, who are saying, we want this national monument to protect our cultural sites, medicines, ceremony, our own identity. We want co-governance with the United States government. What are we afraid of when we see our own leaders in Congress, whether it's Rob Bishop or Ted Cruz or our own governor and our legislature resisting this? To me, we have an opportunity here in our own state to make peace with our past. And I hope President Obama is listening to the tribes and those of us in this country that are saying our national parks aren't something that belong to our past. They are very much present. And I think this is one example of how to look forgiveness in our ongoing relationship with the parks, which is complicated.
It's kind of an underlying theme in some ways in this book, that the reality of the Native experience versus the kind of white experience. And you talk about this myth that you believed, you say for a time, that Yellowstone was void of people.
Yeah, again, the story, the tale, that it was, that Indian people did not go near it, that they were superstitious, that it was loaded with spirits. You know, again, what a great myth, when in fact, the United States government didn't want them around.
Yeah.
You know, they wanted the pastoral image of deer and elk, and it wasn't until much, much later where, you know, you start thinking and you think, this doesn't make sense. And then you start going deeper and you find those other narratives.
And you see later in the book that you write about embedding traditional knowledge with traditional land management as a way to sort of heal that the fact that we've neglected Native Americans from these spaces, or at least are thinking about that.
And not only Native people, not only Indian people, but Black people. And, you know, I think one of the great stories, again, where I wish Wally Stegner was alive, you know, to have this conversation, but he talks famously about how our national parks are our best idea. I would argue they are an evolving idea.
Yeah.
And nowhere is that more beautifully expressed than when you look in our history at 1916. You have Stephen Mather, who is the first director of the Park Service. He made his millions through borax, what, 20 mule teams strong?
Yeah.
And he would have these millionaire dinners in Great Smoky National Park. And really just they needed money to buy up more land to, you know, create an infrastructure. His real concern was, would Mrs. Astor have a nice place to stay in Yellowstone Valley? And hence the Awani. They named the hotel after the very people that they displaced. What I love is that 100 years later, we have a Black president who is a community organizer who in 2012 honors another community organizer named Cesar Chavez. And when Brooke and I went there to La Paz, where the United Farm Workers organized around these ideas of labor, it was so incredibly moving. And this is, I think more than anything, what this book gave me was, I fell back in love with our own country, about, you know, the values that matter to us, like awe and beauty and justice and fairness and the absolute diverse history that we have that are exemplified in our historical parks, our wilderness parks, and monuments. And that thrills me. And I think one of the intentions of writing this book is you and I both know public lands are under siege. You know, our, again, political leaders want to take the public out of lands. And, you know, people don't really care much about the BLM, even the Forest Service, especially back east. The BLM they think is a car or an airlines or a disease. But people do love their national parks. When you figure over 300 million people are visiting them, I thought this is a way in to talking about our public lands as our public commons, as a breathing space.
It's interesting you write that you have not wanted to, and here's how you put it in the book, hide behind lyricism or metaphor as you have in the past. Explain what you mean by that. Does that mean that that the time for lyricism and metaphor, maybe it's still here, but you're thinking of something more active voice? What do you mean by that? What do you mean by lyricism and metaphor? You don't want to hide behind that like you did.
Because I love the world so much, and especially the wild world, it's easy for me to wax rhapsodic.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I do.
Yeah.
And I don't have a mind that can tell things straight. You know, anyone that knows me, I do not have a logical mind. I have a circular mind. I have an organic mind. I see in patterns. I had to really push myself and stretch myself to say it straight, to write a straight narrative, and to do the historical research, to do the scientific explorations. And not that I don't do that. I remember my office at the Museum of Natural History was completely draped with hydrological reports, and yet I never discussed that in Refuge. But I had to write about it. The lake couldn't be a metaphor. In this instance, I guess what I'm saying is I'm not a scientist. I'm not a historian. I'm not a public lands person. I'm a storyteller. But in fairness to the depth of these topics, and in order to reach an audience that maybe doesn't think about public lands, I had to honor them in a language that was familiar, not foreign. This couldn't be an obscure book.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I can't help myself, and it sneaks in with strangeness. But I think that's voice. But that's how this book challenged me. And I have to say, I think my editor made me a stronger writer by also demanding that.
So what did it end up? What did the book end up being, do you think? I mean, how did you? And I want to ask you about the poetry of Jorie Graham. Because this idea of the hour of land is one of those sort of themes that you kind of weave throughout.
The title came to me in a dream,
huh.
Which most of my titles do, speaking of not a logical mind. I remember it was the same with The Open Space of Democracy. You know, do the work while you're asleep. And it was like, what is the essence of this book? Go to sleep. And then when I wake up, it's that morning mind. And what came was, this is the hour of land. I had been carrying the London Review of Books with me for weeks. And in that particular issue, I think it was January of 2015, was a poem by Jorie Graham called We.
Yeah.
It is such a powerful poem. And I think it's about climate change. I think it's about where we find ourselves. I think it's about uncertainty and beauty at once. And I read that poem every day. And there were particular lines that became my directive. And I took those 13 lines, and the first one was by definition. And for me, that charted the course. What are our national parks by definition?
Yeah.
And then, you know, that became the ladder that I climbed. The terror was suddenly, you know, here you have a structure of a book. And would Jorie allow me to use those lines? And I don't know if you know Jorie, but I have such respect for her. She's such a powerful, potent poet and a formidable intellect. In person, and she was so unbelievably generous.
What did you call her?
I actually didn't dare. I emailed her
with
a long, long letter that took weeks to write. And Jorie and I go way back. We both taught at Breadloaf. I also worked with her at Iowa, and so we're friends. We have been, you know, we're friends. We just don't see each other often, and we had a great conversation. And she even clarified for me in a deeper realm of what collaboration is. So those are the sentences that strike the emotional landscape of the book. And let me just read some of them because I think they're so beautiful. By definition, keep promise. All this is what the wind knows. The stones, the steel, the galaxies. There is no prevailing. Death, yes, but as a gathering. Any wind will tell you. There is no private space. What more shall we do to others, to otherness? We are in some strange wind, says the wind. The bodies are all gone from it. The purchases have been made. It is so extreme, this taking the place of, this standing in for, this disappearing of all the witnesses. I say to myself, keep on. It will not be the end. Not yet.
She obviously said yes.
She did say yes, and I'm so grateful. And, you know, I think this book is nothing if not a collaboration. And that mattered to me because I think that our form as writers needs to hold the space of the intent of the book. And national parks are collaborations. And so not only is this a collaboration with Jory Graham, the poet, with her lines, but it's also a collaboration with 23 different photographers.
Yeah.
And call it a postmodern expression of the visual landscapes, again, the emotional landscapes. This is not a book of calendar images.
No. I want to come back to the images, too, because it's like you're curating this little museum in the book.
And Frisch Brandt was amazing, who is president of the Frenkel Gallery in San Francisco. And we spent 3 years really poring over images of what would speak to both the landscape as well as the stories.
Before we head to a break, I want to ask you this. You say early in the book that that this book is about relationships inside national parks. What do you mean, relationships? Why is that important?
I think it's relationship to the land. You go to Grand Teton, and those granite peaks are bedrock. You go to Arches, and you are in relationship with erosion. Windows carved out of stone through wind, water, and time. I also think it's relationships with the people that we visit the national parks with,
yeah.
Most often our families.
Yeah.
I can't believe the weddings and, you know, the ashes scattered. These are memory palaces. So I think it's, and ultimately I think it's relationship with our histories and relationship with ourself. What does it mean to be human? And how does this national park illuminate and elucidate our humanity?
There's a man you met at, I think this was Big Bend National Park. Bill Summers was his name, a veteran. Turns out to be a friend of a friend, Doug Peacock. A lot of people will know that name. Would you say something about Bill Summers? Because you sort of begin the book with meeting him, that sort of chance meeting with him and him knowing Doug Peacock and being a veteran and finding solace, as Doug Peacock did, in wildness as a way to deal with the violence of war.
You know, these are those serendipitous moments. Brooke and I were in Big Bend. If I ever disappear, that's where I'll be. And we noticed this vet in fatigues, Desert Storm, picking up garbage along the highway. And there were no people in Big Bend in January, I can assure you. I think there may have been 40. We actually asked. I'm not counting, you know, the park rangers and volunteers, but he was always picking up garbage, and I was so moved by that. And then we went to one of the visitor centers, and there's a beautiful desert garden, and I was just walking the trail, looking at Cholla and, you know, Palo Verde and Yucca, and all of a sudden we struck up a conversation, and I had asked him. I said, you know, we've noticed you along the side of the road. Tell me about that. And he said, I'm a volunteer, ma'am. You know, I just came back from Hawaii, from the volcanoes. He said, you know, I'm a vet. I was in Desert Storm. Homeland Security. This is what I do, and I can't think of a more honorable way to protect the country that I love than taking care of wild places. And he was in his mind, and in fact, by his own definition, part of the Border Patrol. And part of that Border Patrol is taking care of the borders, not with a wall, but with his heart. And he was now becoming a volunteer at Big Bend. And what was so powerful, I said, oh, you have to meet this friend of mine who wrote about grizzly bears. And he said, that wouldn't be Doug Peacock, would it, ma'am? And I said, yes, it would. And he said, Ed Abbey, Doug Peacock, they've kept me sane. And he said, you know, please tell Mr. Peacock thank you. And we were both in tears. And I remember calling Doug immediately after and telling Doug, and he said, please tell Mr. Summers I love him. So I think it's, again, these unexpected stories. And in truth, the 200,000 volunteers of our National Park Service, the majority of them are vets and seniors.
Oh. Terry Tempest Williams is with us, the author of numerous books. Her latest is The Hour of Land, A Personal Topography of America's National Parks. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer, naturalist Terry Tempest Williams, back with us talking about her latest book. It's called The Hour of Land, A Personal Topography of America's National Parks. So Gettysburg National Military Park, that surprised me. Of the 12 that you could have chosen, it surprised me a little. Not a park that people think of as sort of as wild. Or did I get that wrong? Like, how did you come up with choosing that one? Because this is one you said you've gone to again and again and again to kind of figure out certain things.
I went because I knew nothing about the Civil War. Yeah. And that may be true with many of us as Westerners. My ignorance, I thought, you know, it belongs to the South, it belongs to the North, it doesn't belong to me.
Yeah.
That was my, again, great mistake. And I would say ignorance, that in fact the Civil War was fought on behalf of the West, of would there be slavery. So it was a huge learning curve for me. I just kept going back and back and back because I didn't get it. I didn't understand it. And I went back every season. And is it a wild place? It's a place of restoration and reenactment. Mm-hmm. It's a storied landscape. You know, what you notice immediately are these furrowed fields of corn. In the fall, I remember them rattling like bones. And you're aware of the tens of thousands of men and brothers who died there, the blood seeping into that soil. And today, if you look up, it is scattered with turkey vultures who, legend has it, still have a memory of carrion. It's a haunting place. It's a powerful place. And as I said, you can go through the entire experience of Gettysburg with licensed guides, go into this, you know, expansive museum and visitor center, and never hear the word slavery mentioned. That's changing now because the historian of the national park saw that this was a lie. But again, complicated.
There's this moment, which seems like the most naive question ever. You come upon these Civil War reenactors and you say, can you explain to me what the Civil War is about?
I thought that was a good place to start.
Yeah, it's a good place to start. It's such a basic question. But the way you deal with it in the book, the sort of the response to that, this idea, as they said to you, that it's we're the underdogs, that this is about the average soldier. And you say the rhetoric that you heard there was something like the rhetoric you hear in the West from the sagebrush. Rebels, you know.
And even members of my own family.
Yeah.
You know, you realize the war's never ended. We're still a country divided. And the enactors from the South and the Southern visitors will tell you this is the war of the Northern aggression, this is about states' rights. And as I listen to them, you know, season after season, you realize this is the same rhetoric we're hearing in the American West. This is an incarnation of the Bundys taking over Malheur, and it is a civil war. And we're seeing it played out in our politics even as we speak, as we are choosing to vote for another president.
You write this. You said you sensed that we will fight for the myth that will support and sustain our point of view at all cost.
I believe that. Not a lot of truth telling.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, we could argue what is the truth, but I think, you know, more and more, Doug, I'm interested in the hard conversations, the conversations no one wants to have. And I think we're so fearful right now.
Yeah.
And everything is being couched in bureaucracies and policies and procedures. And, you know, you can't even find a real human being on the phone. And at what cost?
Yeah.
So I just think, you know, part of being human is daring to talk to one another.
Do you ever feel like, and do you worry that in some way in your career you've, not intentionally, but in some ways insulated or isolated yourselves from, I don't know, you always had your dad. Seems like he could always sort of get you back there, center you back
and
into another point of view.
A real family, like everyone's
yeah,
family.
Yeah, that's true, I guess.
So I don't think I'm insulated, yeah. And I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, yeah.
And
your father is kind of a character in the book in some ways, and I'm wondering what role you figure he played in giving you different perspectives. I mean, he plays a role at various times. He challenges your thinking about oil and gas development, for example. That's another thing that sort of comes up. But how did he change? I guess he's always altered your perspective on these things, maybe.
I love my father, and he's my best friend. You know, he's known me since birth, and, you know, he would tell you I had every indication of being perfectly normal, you know, until I was, I would say till I was 13 or 14 and started to menstruate, you know, became a girl. But no, I love my father, and he has been out in the world, and he has laid, you know, the Tempest Company. They've laid pipe all across the West. And
I'm proud of those
Western
scars,
states.
He said.
Absolutely. So it is the other point of view. But by the same token, nothing is simple. And you know, he loves the land more than anyone I know, and he can out-hike the best of us now at 82. And it was a privilege to be with my father in Theodore Roosevelt National Park with Valerie Naylor and to hear those stories. And again, you know, to celebrate his 80th birthday with our extended family in Grand Teton National Park. And, you know, being with Brooke, and our son, Louis Gakumba, who was with me in Gettysburg. And that, again, the perspective of a Black African versus an African American. I want to read you this one passage from Gettysburg because I think it talks about both the complexity and oversimplification of something as complex as the Civil War. Our car is back at the parking lot at Pitzer's Woods, where we left General Longstreet on his horse. A makeshift camp has been set up by a half dozen reenactors, whom we pass to get to our vehicle. Howdy. How's it going? Good. We're about to go bowling for Yankees. Excuse me, I ask? We're artillery, ma'am. We're setting up our hardware. I see. Forgive my ignorance, but I know very little about Civil War artillery. Can you explain what you're doing? Sure. We're support for the infantry, the men on foot. Artillery doesn't win wars, feet on the ground do. We're interested in taking you out before you engage our troops. The man I'm engaging with is large, bearded, with sandy-colored hair, perhaps in his mid-40s. He's got an eagle tattoo on one bicep and a Confederate flag on the other, both tattoos showcased by sleeveless gray T-shirt. He and his cohort carry what looks to be a small cannon out of the bed of his pickup. Our job, ma'am, is to emotionally debilitate you. And you're with the Confederate Army, he says, interrupting Brooke. We're part of the 2nd Company of Richmond Howitzers, setting up support for the Army of Northern Virginia. Tomorrow we'll be dressed up and firing the cannons. He pauses. This here is a 12-pound Napoleon. So anyway, it goes on, and then here's the question. Can you explain to me what the Civil War is about? It's complicated, ma'am. Let me put it to you this way. The North is more industrial with lots of textile factories. The South is more agricultural, growing cotton, sending it up north. The government is setting up heavy import taxes on us, so we're fighting to get the federal government out of our lives. It's about our economics and our right to govern ourselves. It's a states' rights thing, ma'am. The North against the South. We're the underdogs. He pulls out some more guns and ammunition from the Civil War era. Do you get it? It's about the average soldier. Say you're invading my town. You think I'm going to let that happen? The fight's local. I'm defending my homeland. Yeah, sure, the bigwigs were trying to direct things and they had their politics, Lee and Longstreet over there. But in the end, it's about defending your own territory. You weren't fighting for a philosophy. You were fighting for your buddy, for your family, for your honor. Now, I'm fighting here in Gettysburg so people like you can stand next to me and ask me these kinds of questions. I mean, I know you come here and you think it's all about slavery. But look at it this way, lady. The feds can't just come in here and tell us what to do. The best way for you to understand the Civil War is to look at the gun issue in the Americas right now. You ain't taking my guns away. Slaves, guns, it's the same issue, just different items.
So how would hearing that not make you think there's no way we're going to resolve any of this stuff?
I think that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we ended up talking to these gentlemen for over an hour. It's a conversation. You know, they changed me.
Yep.
I can't say that I had any impact on them. But again, it's exchanging stories. And I don't know what will change this.
But isn't that it, though? I mean, it's not... Oh, I'm going to say that one thing that's finally going to make you see the light. Like, that's not how it works.
It's a give and take,
right?
And not only the give and take, but I honestly believe, Doug, it's about listening.
Yeah.
I think it's in the listening that we are transformed. And that, to me, may be the most important thing that this journey through these 12 national parks gave me, was this deep-seated sense of listening and how vital that is to our sanity, to our survival, to our evolution as a species and as a human being. There isn't a lot of listening going on in this country right now.
Terry Tempest Williams is with us. She is, her latest book is The Hour of Land, A Personal Topography of America's National Parks. She's going to be reading from and talking about the book at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center here in Salt Lake City. That's next Tuesday night. The National Parks, that's the name of the band. They're from Provo. They're going to be performing at the event. It's sponsored by the King's English Bookshop, and you can get details about it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back with Terry Tempest Williams. We're talking about her latest book, The Hour of Land, A Personal Topography of America's National Parks. What is it about Maine that makes you swoon? That's what you said in the book. That is so different from where you grew up.
I know. I love the ocean. I love the rocks. I love that balsam firs bleed into the shore. You know, it's mountains, it's forests, it's ocean, it's edges.
It's interesting, though, too, because you say that person from the West, you said it's everything your home in the West is not, but when you first went there, you said it was kind of immediately familiar. That's how you put it, familiar.
Yeah, my uncle and aunt... Richard and Ruth Tempest and their family went to Cambridge, Massachusetts to serve a mission for New England. Hmm. And I want to say as kids, you know, we were in our 20s or 30s, while Rich and Ruth were in church, we just took the car and went down east. Lynn and I and Brooke, and it was just, we fell in love with it. And it did feel strangely familiar.
There was a time when I wondered, because you lived there for a time.
Our family has a place there,
yeah.
Lynn, and, you know, it's really become my secret. It's just, I don't know enough about the Northeast and New England and Maine in particular to have my heart broken. So it's a great relief, because whereas I think in the American West, particularly in the American Southwest, we're in the middle of massive disturbance and destruction of the lands we love. And they're on the other side of restoration, so that all of those forests that were felled, that the logs floating down the Great Penobscot River, they're now in second, third, fourth growth.
What's the difference?
What do you mean?
Well, what's the difference in the way they think about it and the way we think about it?
I mean, there's still contention right now. As you know, Maine Northwoods could become a national monument. And, you know, it's the same conversation we're having here and that what we had with Grand Staircase Escalante. What's the difference?
If there is one.
I don't think I know enough to know.
Yeah.
I just know that when I go there, I am restored, even as the woods have been restored. Even as every day the tides come in, the tides go out, it is a landscape of deep restoration to me.
Grand Teton National Park, that makes sense for you to include this. This is an important place for your father. And your grandfather.
And our great-grandfather.
Really?
So it's a generational landscape. And I have no memory without the Grand Tetons. In fact, my first memory is at Hidden Falls, with my mother on one side and my grandmother on the other. I'm kneeling down with cupped hands, drinking deeply from that pool of cold, fresh water. Not a year of my life has not been spent there.
You describe it as your mother.
The mother park.
The mother park.
I thought for years that the Grand Teton was Mount Moran. And, you know,
your dad scolded you about that.
Well,
after a while.
I just thought, you know, they're talking about the Grand Teton. And to me, that mountain seemed the grandest.
Yeah, yeah.
And it wasn't until much later, embarrassingly so, that Dad said, "What's wrong with you? Of course, that's the Grand Teton." But, you know, Moran does feel like the mother mountain. And that's the mountain that holds me like a buttress.
You say your consciousness toward a land ethic was born there.
Teton Science School, Ted Major. I'm at the University of Utah. It's a weekend field trip to the Teton Science School for 3 credit hours. What's not to love about that? We went up there. It changed my life. It was, you know, seeing lodgepole pines, hearing about fire ecology, serotonous cones that break open from heat and replant themselves. That was the closest thing I knew to resurrection. Ted Major was the first Democrat I ever met. You know, it was a good field trip.
There's a, let's talk about Big Bend National Park. That surprised me too, for I don't know why. It was nice to be surprised by some of these choices. You had 12.
Big Bend just shocked the hell out of me.
Why?
You know, it's so vast. It's so bare. It's so beautiful. And it's so...
Wait, what's beautiful about it?
That we were there in January. I went back again in March. The flowering of the yuccas, of the bluebonnets, the javelinas, their eyes shine at night. Walking up these washes, you don't see a soul. And then finding yourself at the end of Santa Elena Canyon, and it looks like a Buddhist temple, a garden of boulders, and you think, we're going to build a wall here? I watched American children skipping stones to Mexican children, and I want to say, Donald Trump, here? You know, it's where my grandmothers were born, the Romneys. You know, it just, and at night, you know, you see that eye shine and you think, is it a human being or is it an animal? And I think it's in Big Bend National Park where I thought, I want to develop night vision. Nothing is as it appears. And these Chisos Mountains, you know, look like sleeping dragons about to be awakened. I think it's that notion that the desert is not a void, but It is our unknowing.
I want to have you read something from this section. It seems like this is the moment where you allowed yourself some joy, though, right?
Oh, there's joy throughout.
It's true.
You know?
It's true.
Let's say that. I have to tell you. But I'll tell you what Big Band was. I let go of human beings. And that was a pleasure. Because, you know, coming out of Gettysburg, yeah. coming out of the Bakken oil fields, yeah. I just said, you know what? I'm done with people, my own species right now, and I just want to focus on plants and animals and insects, and that is its own joy.
Which of these do you want to read? There's the one about the hawk, which is...
I can read that.
Will you? Will you say something about that?
Well, what I love is that you never know where you're going, or I should say I never know where I'm going. So, you know, you wake up in the morning and just follow your nose.
Well, and we should say that what you did is you had these colored notebooks.
Mm-hmm.
And so each day you would just write, it was almost like a poem in these pieces, these
right.
essays.
We were there for 2 weeks. The average park visit is 2.3 days. You know, and I felt like we had no time there. And the yeah. park rangers were going, what? You're here for 2 weeks? And I did. I filled 12 notebooks joyously. And this was a day I thought I was going on a long hike, but something intervened. Day 12, white notebook. White Datura, awakened by dreams, calls forth moths drenched in pollen light. Moon and stars on water moves bright. Yucca stalks a canyon's mind. White is white if the eye is to believe a cottontail in motion is a life saved by speed. Cloud's cotton delusion becomes white rich with tales. Once upon a time, white wolves and camels led soldiers back from war. In the desert, the mirage of water as angels is replaced with sandstone, the color of everything broken. My notebook is painted with rabbit blood in one Sumi brushstroke. The morning did not begin as planned. I was prepared to walk to the Mule's Ears, two volcanic plugs that have eroded into a seismic view that shakes the horizon. Fog filled the Chisos Basin where I was staying, and it was a dramatic descent into clouds. All along the road, cottontails darted in and out, and I had to slow way down not to hit them. I wondered who was benefiting from the explosion of rabbits, perfect packets of protein. Near the upper Borome-Saporov trail, I saw something standing in the road. It was a red-tailed hawk, with her talons clamped on a freshly killed cottontail. The rabbit's head was facing the Chisos, its ears resting back on its body, the long black back legs in direct alignment with its head. It was a perfect portrait, predator and prey. The hawk and the rabbit were close, but I wanted details. Through my binoculars, the red tail had a crest, something I had not noticed before, nor had I appreciated the sharp point of her beak and the bright yellow cirri above it. The hawk's beak breaks the skull like an ice pick, beak to brain, red flesh is being eaten in small bites, plucked rabbit fur is pulled apart from the muscle, cartwheels across the road, beak to brain, tear, gulp, tear, the raptor eats the eyes more slowly, and then, in three gulps, she swallows the ears whole. In less than 5 minutes, the rabbit's head has been devoured. The shoulders are next. The hawk pulls out from the rabbit one long red strand, and for a moment, predator and prey appear joined by an umbilicus. The back legs of the rabbit are now crossed, relaxed, a headless offering. Redtail tightens her grip, ripping and pulling each strip of sinew and muscle with a measured ferocity, swallowing each tender whole. The hawk looks up, waits, her eyes focused on the horizon, then drags the rabbit off the road to the soft shoulder and doesn't move. Several minutes later, a truck passes. The red tail flies down the slope with the rabbit clutched in her talons. The hawk lands, beak to flesh, finishes the cottontail that she has been eating, leaving behind a coil of intestines. Patches of fur now take flight as feathers. The red-tailed hawk takes three jumps before becoming airborne once again.
You say that our greatest transformation as a species is going to have to be spiritual. Would you say something about that finally?
I think the crisis that we find ourselves in this country, we say it's political, we say it's economic, we might even say it's ecological. But in the end, Doug, I do think it's spiritual. Remembering who we are, where we come from, and what we care about. Soul life.
Terry Tempest Williams. Her new book is The Hour of Land, A Personal Topography of America's National Parks. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.